Al Giordano rules. Oh, hold on. Al is doing a tweet. Al did a tweet essay about how we supposedly sent dude, bro, we sent fake accounts to donate him. You are out of your fucking gourd,
Wait,
Al.
us personally?
Yes.
Oh shit,
What?
wait, Al is listening to the Trap House?
Yeah.
Oh my god, this is great.
Oh my God. What a fucking psycho.
Dude, Al, we want people to give you
Yeah, we
fucking
want
money.
you
Are
to
you kidding
get.
me? Like, dude, I want to keep this joke running for as long as it goes.
Oh my God, you are fucking out of your mind, Al. Hold on, let me. Can I read this? Can I read this?
Yeah, wait, did you just find this
Yeah,
out?
no, I just got it. Two, this podcast began by comparing online harassment of women to being a Rambo-like soldier of fortune. Clear masculinity issues. Three, coincidentally, the guest on the podcast was a Jacobin writer notorious for obsessing about women writers and stalking them online. Four, anyway,
Look.
the polo of dude bros on the podcast were so obsessed with me and talked about how they'd stalk me on social media. Five, their plan was foiled. It was to have fake accounts troll me with messages of support that I would fall for and later get owned.
Dude, we were talking about how Scotty Burberry was doing the fake accounts, not us.
Oh, you fucking moron.
Hey, look,
Yeah,
I think there's
he was a moron because we were talking about how he was convinced to run by the multiple accounts of delusional Hillary man Scotty Burberry. We didn't say anything about us creating these accounts. Jesus Christ, Al.
Oh my God,
Okay,
what a fucking
Al,
idiot.
I know we were talking to Connor Kilpatrick of Jacobin. I know we did the Rambro joke about harassing women, but I just want to make clear, if there's one, we are against stalking and harassing women online. Like female
Yeah.
journalists who are exceptionally attractive, we are against emailing them, stalking them, or calling them cutie and things like that. We're against
We're
that.
against, yeah, we're against telling them that we want to meld our souls with theirs. We're totally against that.
I've never done that. None of
Never.
us have ever done that, and we never will. So, I just want that on the record. But holy shit, that is hilarious.
Oh my, I love it when a bulletin comes in.
Yeah,
That's
this is breaking
fucking
news
awesome.
live.
This
This is
is Al
great.
Giordano rules. He fucking Al, we never want you to stop. We never want you to stop.
It's coming over. Come on. Fresh off the transom here. Al Giordano is declared war on
I love him.
Episode 14. It's episode 14, everybody, of Chapo Trap House. We are back. It's me, Will Meniker, with my buds, my pals, Matt Christman
Hey, folks.
and Felix Biederman.
Hey, everybody.
We're back again this week. We got a lot to talk about. I just want to open the show with a couple things that if you are a Grey Wolf subscriber, you already heard us discuss a little bit on this week's premium show. But if you are not in the inner circle yet, I just want to give you update you on a couple things that we were discussing in the subscription show. You missed out on us. We swung for the fences on a lot of things, but mainly on the Federalist's Molly Hemingway and the Vermont Senate campaign of Al Giordano. If you're a subscriber, you heard us discuss these stories. There are now over 1,000 of you, which is amazing. Keep it coming. And then the other thing I want to update the non-Grey Wolves, the non-subscribers on, is, like I mentioned before, Al Giordano. We duck hunted him on the premium show this week, and I just want to update everyone on his. He is now has a Kickstarter for his. See, the thing is, you can't have a Kickstarter for a political campaign. So he has a Kickstarter in place now called Send Al to Vermont for the No Nukes Oral History Project. So, and it says, "Help Al return to Vermont to interview the veterans of the Vermont Yankee Decommissioning Alliance, of which he was a key organizer, created by School for Authentic Journalism." Okay, here's the punchline. He's already raised $14,000.
Jesus Christ.
Oh
This
my
just
God.
goes to show, we talk all the time about how horseshoe theory might be bullshit, but there's a very significant parallel between the personalities of Teacott and Unite Blue. And one of them is that they are the most gormlessly naive idiots, and anybody with any kind of angle can fucking fleece them just so easily. Either you want to do a quixotic, pointless doom send a campaign against the evil Bernie bro in chief, or you want to open a homophobic pizzeria. These people will open their fucking checkbooks. How any of them have any money left? Because they, I mean, how have these guys all not been scammed by like a Nigerian prince who tells them that, you know, he's ready for Hillary, or that he's a member of the Cruise crew?
Oh, wait, what's this? A toothless man wants to stop nukes by going to Vermont. Is there a limit on how much I can give you?
He wants to equip the dumpster he lives in with an engine and wheels so he can drive to Vermont?
Yeah, I mean, like, thank you to you, snarky mom for Hillary. Al Giordano will not have to hop the caboose car to Vermont as he previously did. He'll be sitting in the dining car with all the folks from the big city who wear this nice suits and smoke chest.
He'll be twiddling his fingers with his fingerless gloves.
It's like I said, his Kickstarter is to go to Vermont and definitely not run against Bernie Sanders. This is not a political campaign. This is an oral history project. But it's already off to a booming start. But someone sent me screenshots, sent us screenshots. Shout out to Morgan D. Rose on Twitter, who sent me these hilarious screenshots of Al is already gaslighting himself about these donations. Because first of all, he said that he's not going to spend a dime of this $14,000 on, like he said, five-star hotels and room service, which I guess is some kind of dig at Bernie Sanders, because you know, people donated all this money to Bernie Sanders, but he's still staying in hotels on the campaign trail. Give me a break, folks.
Is it? Don't you guys think it's kind of ironic that Bernie Sanders runs against money in politics, but he's spent money his entire life?
I've lost all respect for the guy. But no, someone sent me these screenshots of him, and someone's responding to him going, "Hey, where can I donate?" And Al's like, "Thanks, right here." And then within like 2 seconds later, he's like replying again in the quote tweet going, "Sorry, dude, bro, you're not going to gaslight me. Blocked." And then someone replies, "Wait, Al, I think you should look at this." And it's like the same person he's blocking has like some tweet that's just like, "I just donated to the Al Kickstarter." So he's blocking people that are actually giving him money. Like, he's gaslighting himself already with this.
It's like if
campaign.
Captain Queeg had a Kickstarter.
And he said, "No, this guy did not donate. He's part of the Brunig Connor Harassing Dude Bro Alliance." Again, best of luck to Al Giordano. I'm actually now really hoping that he succeeds, because I think, you know, Bernie, he's an old, you know, he's getting up there, and I think it's time maybe for him to retire. And I think we need fresh blood. We need a guy who's 60 to, you know, not 70 to slide in there and hold down a Senate seat from Vermont. We're going to go into our main topic for this week, which is, you know, the final rise of Hillary Clinton. You know, like this week we saw Hillary won California, and now it's like officially, you know, all over. Hillary Clinton is the Democratic nominee in all but name only. I mean, we way back when she won New York, you know, like this was already over months ago, but like now it's basically official. And we were prepared for this for a long time, but what I underestimated was just the sheer volume of nauseating sort of Hillary pieces that came out this week. And as hardened and cynical as I am, I actually wasn't prepared for them, because holy shit, they were all so, so bad.
Yeah, it's like, you know, maybe there is a real genuine hostility to the left of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I think we should start off now.
Could be.
With the worst thing that I read this week. I think we just need to dive right in it. It's like a really cold pool. You know, you can't, you know, put a toe in first. You just got to jump in. So I'm going to go, let's go straight into what was hands down the worst thing I read this week. And it was from Ezra Klein at Vox. The headline was, "It's time to admit Hillary Clinton is an extraordinarily talented politician." Wow, what a brave stand that Ezra's taking here. This is a really hot take. I don't know if people are ready for it.
Yeah, I know GE might pull funding after that courageous of a stance.
God, before I start this, this is just like Ezra Klein. I mean, this is just like he is such a fucking ass kisser. Listen to just the sound of him going, just brown nosing this entire time. It's so bad. And everything he says is also stupid and full of shit. But okay, let's just go. Ezra writes, "This is the paradox of Hillary Clinton. She has achieved something no one else in the history of the American politics has ever come close to doing, yet is widely considered an inept, flawed candidate. These two things are not unrelated. Twice now, we have thought it should be easy for Clinton to do what no one has ever done before. Twice now, we have dismissed her as a weak candidate and a flawed leader for struggling to break a barrier no one else has ever come near to breaking. America has hosted 56 presidential elections, 33 of them before women received the right of vote. Exactly zero of those elections featured a female nominee from one of the two major American political parties, until Hillary Clinton." Okay, so he's setting it up once again, like that Hillary is an underdog all over again. And again, in 2008, just like now, Hillary Clinton was absolutely the favorite both times. Okay, so Ezra continues. "There is something about Clinton that makes it hard to appreciate the magnitude of her achievement. Or perhaps there is something about us that makes it hard to appreciate the magnitude of her achievement."
When you don't appreciate mother.
"Perhaps in ways we still do not fully appreciate, the reason no one has ever broken the glass ceiling in American politics is because it's really fucking hard to break."
Oh, Ezra, my God, he's
breaking out a swear word.
Oh, my God. Dark Ezra.
Too hot for Vox.
Dude, you may see Ezra on In the Weeds or the Ezra Klein Show. He's wearing his Windsor nut tie. But dude, you get a little Guinness in that motherfucker. He's busting out the F-bombs.
When he typed that, he like leaned back in his chair and like whipped the lanyard around behind his back? And just
it's
like,
in
yeah,
italics.
That's right. I said it. I fucking
it's in
said
italics.
It.
It's in italics. There are no dashes.
He was actually typing it with one hand because he was holding a mic in the other hand and dropped it. The
it's really fucking hard to break.
Son, where'd you find this?
"Whether you like Hillary Clinton or hate her, and plenty of Americans hate her, it's time to admit that the reason Clinton was the one to break it is because Clinton is actually really good at politics. She's just good at politics in a way we haven't learned to appreciate." Ugh. This is now the second part of the essay is called "How Presidential Campaigns Favor Male Traits." And What is so good about this article is that, like, Ezra is so hyped. He's so hyped up to explain, to just appreciate the magnitude of a woman breaking the highest glass ceiling of all, that he tries to, and why we still can't appreciate it. And, like, he tries to square that circle and, like, you know, demonstrate for everyone his feminist, woke bona fides. But what he actually does is say a lot of shit that's actually really sexist. Like, he sort of, and we'll get into that. But Hillary Clinton has her flaws, of course. The email server, the speeches to Goldman Sachs, and just look at her unfavorable numbers. I'll say that in her flaws, Ezra doesn't mention her disastrous foreign policy. He doesn't mention Libya or Iraq or Syria or Honduras or Haiti or any of that. It's just the email server and Goldman Sachs. But what really defines coverage of Clinton is the confusion over how she's gotten so far without the animal charisma typical of politicians at her level. Clinton employed a less masculine strategy to win. She won the Democratic Party by spending years slowly and assiduously building relationships with the entire Democratic Party. She relied on a more traditionally female approach to leadership, creating coalitions, finding common ground, and winning over allies. Today, 208 members of Congress have endorsed Clinton, and only 8 have endorsed Sanders. This work is a grind. It's not big speeches, it doesn't come with wide applause, but it requires an emotional toughness that most human beings can't summon. Okay, this is what's so stupid and actually offensive about what Ezra's writing, is this whole idea about male and female qualities in politics, or what are, you know, a female strategy for, you know, winning in politics. And what he describes is just actual politics. There's nothing female about that. What, if anything, what he's describing is the old, you know, machine style of politics. Like, you know, again, shout out to our good friend Amber Lee Frost, who responded to this. So I think the best take on this is that the actually traditional female way of doing politics that Hillary Clinton did was marrying a president or leader. Everything else Ezra describes in this article is just ascribing things like being nurturing or being a good listener as natural to women, and embodying, like, this is Hillary Clinton's strategy for doing politics, and not just the fact that, as you said, she's representing the interests of, like, the most powerful constituencies in the Democratic Party.
I like how Ezra, like, in his attempt to understand how regular human beings work, has become, like, an indigo child mommy blogger, getting into that real motherfucking gender science. It's like Nicole Mullen writing about politics.
But, I mean, like, did anyone ever, like, who is he responding to here? Did anyone ever really say that Hillary Clinton isn't a talented politician? Like, she's immensely disliked.
I think that is, I mean, it's not one of those things where anybody is, like, associated with that point of view specifically, but I think that's just I think it's a commonplace. I think people kind of think she's a bad campaigner. I really do think that he underestimates, when people talk about how she's not a good politician, generally what they mean is that she keeps doing and saying terrible shit.
Yeah, that people
it's
don't
not that
like.
She doesn't have the raw animal charisma of a Mitt Romney or John Kerry.
Yeah, no, I mean, because like Ezra is entirely focused. You know, he's nominally a wonk, but he's entirely focused on optics and bullshit. So none of these people can address the idea that maybe some people don't like Hillary out of policy differences. There are absolutely people who have, like, a personal hatred of her, but I think a lot of what you saw in the actual election that has taken place so far is a large number of people who reject her policy choices throughout her career. But because, like, admitting that would allow that there are millions of people who are ameliorable to sort of a social democratic coalition, you have to go in this weird fucking gender science category where you go, well, the woman has a blue energy, and the man has a red energy. And while the blue energy works for general consensus, the red energy causes the man to go into the third moon of Venus.
And, like, you know, and this whole thing about the magnitude of her achievement is, like, what annoys me is, again, they're, like, as I said at the beginning of this, they're trying to cast her again as, like, the underdog, that this is, like, a miraculous comeback victory against Bernie Sanders. When, you know, I think, again, I think Matt Taibbi said it best this week, where it was like Hillary Clinton winning the nomination like this would be like, you know, if the Golden State Warriors were pushed to game 7 and then had to have like a fourth quarter comeback against like a NCAA team. Like, would they be really feeling great about themselves if they had to do that?
I can't be the only one that thinks if investment bankers, defense contractors, Hollywood studio billionaires, and the entire Democratic Party establishment got together, they could win 55% of the vote against Bernie Sanders. I can't be the only one who thinks that.
Like, you know, there are a lot, you know, there is a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters who I think are, you know, I think a lot of this narrative about, oh, she's stealing or it's rigged or whatever is a little dumb. And like, you know, oh, the delegate math or whatever. I mean, I guess like she's stealing it, but in a way that like everyone else steals it. You know what I mean? Like, it's like saying, I don't think the Harlem Globetrotters...
Like all the worst theft in America, it's totally legal and above board.
Exactly. Like, I don't think the Harlem Globetrotters are, like, stealing games against the Washington Generals. But if the Washington Generals, like, took it to, like, a buzzer
no
beater...
He's just spinning the ball! Take it!
I mean, yeah, the Democratic Party and the sort of the whole primary process is, like, the officials in a Harlem Globetrotters Washington Generals game, basically. But everyone going into that sort of knew it. So it's a little hard to complain about it. But
yeah, a little bit. I mean,
it's still annoying, but...
Yeah, I mean, I think for the most part, people kind of knew what was going to happen. Like, I mean, after Illinois, we were all of us and pretty much most of the people we knew were like, well, I mean, he's not going to get it now. It'll be interesting to see how far this will go. But I think, like, a lot of these are addressed at, like, the 10 people online who are like, no, she's going to get indicted. They're going to indict Obama for endorsing her. But it's easy to address those people.
Yeah, and it just, I don't know, just the ass kissing in that Ezra Klein article. I mean, like, he's just so bowled over by it.
Hey, man,
like,
he wants access to the Clinton administration.
I mean, this
he's
is
gotta fucking sweeten that beef.
This is his fucking career. You know, this is his career strategy. And like, okay, now I found this one, and I want to read just one more clip from Ezra Klein because this is what he wrote about Obama.
You promise it's the last one?
I promise this is the last Ezra Klein one. But get a bucket ready if it's handy next year. This is what he wrote about Obama in 08. Look, this is what he wrote about Obama in 08. Ezra writes, Obama's finest speeches do not excite. They do not inform. They don't really even inspire. They elevate. They enmesh you in a grander moment, as if history has stopped flowing passively by and just for an instant contracted around you, made you aware of its presence and your role in it. He is not the word made flesh, but the triumph of word over flesh, over color, over despair.
Oh my God.
The other great leaders I've heard.
Oh my God.
He's not the word made flesh. I mean,
he is the conquest of word over. He is the logos.
Oh my God.
It just was almost.
See, that's the kind of shit that all those idiot Republicans were screaming in Obama's first term about OBOTs.
Yeah, that's
exactly
what they were talking about.
Yeah, this is what version of what they were complaining
Ezra,
about.
You fucking deserve it, man. Have some fucking self-respect. Like, dude it's just almost ever. He says, the other great leaders I've heard guide us toward a better politics, but Obama is, at his best, able to call us back to our highest selves, to a place where America exists as a glittering ideal, and where we, its honored inhabitants, seem capable of achieving it, and thus sharing in its meaning and transcendence. Oh, God.
Wait a minute, are you talking about the guy who spent the last 6 years with his thumb up his ass, just like desultorily droning Yemen?
Yeah, this
and doing literally nothing else.
Yeah, as I described him earlier this week, Ezra is talking about our, you know, mildly liberal technocratic manager of the U.S. empire, and that he's enmeshing us in a moment grander than ourselves. I mean, give me a fucking break, man. Like I said, like, it just just have some fucking self-respect, like. But yeah,
you gotta make sure that the comms office picks up your phone calls.
I guess that's how you do it.
You gotta do, man.
It's
just what it is.
This is fucking debasing.
So yeah, so that was the first wave was just this kind of nauseating adulation for Hillary, the woman finally, you know, achieving the hopes and dreams of every woman who's ever existed in America. But the second wave was more the kind of the more embittered and angry about that Bernie's still in it and that Bernie bros are, again, it's like the more Hillary is assured of the nomination, the angrier these people get at Bernie's supporters for, you know, being a spoiler or whatever. And a lot of it coalesced around this article that was published in the Daily Beast. Again, a worthless publication that will, you know, give a byline to anyone. Just people off the street, they're letting write articles for them. It's sad, really.
They let the dumbest, most worthless, no talent, piece of shit, sleep on the floor in the mattress, host a dude bro podcast people write articles for them. Shameful.
They let sentient jugs of creatine write articles.
But yeah, no, it was this article about this guy, what's his name, Christopher Ketchum or whatever, about how, you know, I didn't even read it, but was he saying that he was going to vote for Trump or that he's profiling Bernie Sanders supporters who will vote for Trump? I don't know. It doesn't matter. But it's this utterly phantom menace about how, you know, the Bernie supporters who are so embittered about Hillary are going to throw the election to Trump by voting for him. This is like the new, this is this utterly sort of chimerical threat. And I want to read now from Michelle Goldberg. One of my favorites from this election in Slate.com. And her article is Leftists for Trumps. What is to be done about these insufferable nihilists? politics is not your personal catharsis. And if I were her editor at Slate Magazine, I would just change that headline slightly to "What is to be done about this utterly insignificant and make-believe threat?" So she writes, last month, the left-wing writer Freddie DeBoer tweeted his desire to see, quote, liberal Democrat writer in the media write a piece making a good faith effort to consider liberal attacks on the left. The challenge stuck in my mind because I'm aware of my own antipathy to many types of the left-wing affect. She writes, I often feel guilty about it and wonder if it's a rationalization for my own smug complacency.
Yes.
Yes, it is. But again, this is in the first paragraph of the article. The move here is you inoculate yourself against the very thing you're doing and you embody by stating it up front. And let's see if it works. She says, after all, I would like to see America move towards Scandinavian-style social democracy, and that's not going to happen without serious left-wing agitation. Why, then, does the left, that is, people who want revolution rather than reform, regularly infuriate me? I'm willing to stipulate that part of it is that leftists make me feel bad about my own bougie accommodation to the status quo. Again, stop the essay there. You just answered your own question, Michelle. But yeah, you're not going to. This is the vaccine that she's doing in this first paragraph. On Wednesday, Christopher Ketchum published a piece in the Daily Beast titled "Anarchists for Trump: Let the Empire Burn." Ketchum, who writes that he donated hundreds of dollars to Bernie Sanders, now plans to support Donald Trump in the general election. And, you know, and then he proceeds to outline what we've already dismissed as, I think, a fairly stupid point of view about that it would be, you know, that it would be positive from a left-wing perspective to have Trump get in office because it would, I don't know, heighten the contradictions or hasten the collapse of the American empire, which we've already dismissed on this show because, you know, if you take seriously the idea that politics should be about improving the material conditions of the average person's life and like increasing their freedom to live a life of dignity and decency on their terms. The only thing worse than living in the American empire on that regard would be living in the collapsed American empire.
Yeah, no, I mean, the entire accelerationist plan for Trump is kind of like people who saw the end for V for Vendetta. The people will rise up. And
yeah, I think that we're going to do really well. I think all the left-wing agenda is going to do really well when General Mad Dog Mattis is ruling the rump American empire in a, like from a back of a Jeep driving around the East Coast in the caravan of death.
I read this like dumb article. The guy in it, they talk about he's a New York media, he's an editor. The guy talks about how he works for a progressive publication, but he can't identify who he is or where he works for because he's afraid of getting funding pulled. There's only like one publication like that would identify itself as progressive that has, you know, doesn't have many funders. That would be Salon. So we're talking about one dickbag Salon editor who's like just kind of like a caricature of what people hate about this type of person, and we're treating it like a moral pandemic. Again. Fucking again.
Well, it's two things. They're doing it out of two motivations. One is they need to discredit this left-wing movement. They have to make it look like it isn't about ideology. It's about the personal pique of a bunch of angry white guys who will throw away the interests of the poor and minorities and allow them to, at the mercy of the Trump stormtroopers, just because they didn't get their way. Because they don't actually have an agenda. They don't have a positive view. They don't really believe what the Sanders campaign is supposed to be. Because they have to discredit that. Because otherwise, you look at the demographics of the Democratic Party and who voted for who, this establishment neoliberal consensus is fucking doomed. Because they're going to get swamped. And they don't want that to happen, so they have to try to discredit it.
We're already seeing a line that says that, you know, Bernie Sanders supporters were equally divided between people who liked Bernie and people who just hated Hillary and are, if anything, actually more conservative than her.
Right, yeah. And that, yeah, they need that to be the case. But then the other half of it is the fact that these are a bunch of craven, just cowardly scumbags who like and are accommodated to losing. In fact, it's probably better for them, for their agendas, to lose, because if they win too much, there's going to be an expectation that they actually fucking implement some of the stuff that they claim to support. But they are also arch careerists who want to maintain their position within this, dysfunctional party, so they need an alibi for if they actually fucking diff this election. Because running against Donald Trump is like the biggest gimme in the history of American presidential politics. But now, because they nominated a stack of credit default swamps, there's an outside chance they could actually lose. And they don't want to be blamed when that happens. So they have the ready-made Bernie bros to point it, to pin it on if it happens.
And so, like, what do you make of this idea that Michelle Goldberg would really like a Scandinavian-style social democracy in America, but she just doesn't like
it? You know, hey, I'm sure she'd like it if she didn't really have to pay any higher taxes or anything.
Yeah.
I think she'd be fine with it.
Yeah,
if she didn't have to do anything, if she didn't have to change her life in any way, and if, yeah, she didn't have to pay anything for it, I'm sure she'd be fine with it.
I don't even know if she has an opinion about it one way or the other. These people don't seem to have any politics outside of – they don't even seem to have any beliefs outside of their own importance.
Well, no. I mean the funniest thing is that she says politics isn't your personal catharsis. But if you look at the people celebrating Hillary's victory
– It very much is their personal catharsis.
There's no – it is all personal catharsis. There is zero actual celebration of the advancement of an agenda. It's entirely Khaleesi memes. It's people who have totally over-identified with Hillary Clinton as a person and who have taken her success as their own and are absolutely seeing politics through this hyper-personalized lens and who view her success as theirs. And yeah, then post 15 GIFs of Khaleesi and Beyonce and then call that their fucking politics.
Did you see the NWA one this week?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
That's one where I retweeted that and I said language was a mistake.
Yeah. I mean, when
William S. Burroughs was right. Human language is a virus. We should get a fucking vaccine.
Hillary was previously a monarch, an inbred monarch with family madness in Khaleesi. Now she is a Republican with AIDS because she's EGE. I mean, we always talk about a big tent strategy.
You know, and then like, you know, sorry, it just, you know, Goldberg writes, Ketchum is naturally blithely uninterested in reckoning with the human cost of the political apocalypse that he fantasizes about. There's not a word in his piece about the immigrants who would be rounded up and put into detention camps under Trump's plans. What about the ones that are already in detention camps under Barack Obama?
Who's deported more people than any president in history?
Again, we talked about this with Connor last time. I got to bring it up. We have to say it again. The apocalypse is already happening. It's already here.
We are in the dystopia. We're in the Verhoeven movie. It's happening now.
And you said fucking Rahm Emanuel, like big time Clinton backer, Democratic Party, is a mayor of a city where the police kill black teenagers and cover it up, who has a literal black site for the torture of minorities.
Who work behind the scenes to elect a Republican governor.
Yeah.
Who has closed public schools all through the city.
My own governor here in New York State, Andrew Cuomo, just passed an actual attack on the First Amendment. This like McCarthyite anti-boycott, divestment, and sanctions thing that will literally create a list that have the state government of New York like blacklist anyone or any institution that supports BDS.
The Democratic governor and Democratic legislature in deep blue Connecticut are in the process of slashing public services and funds to everything they can find and cutting taxes to the wealthy.
Yeah, no, I mean, what was Obama's big news dump before we went into our weekend? It was expanding the war in Afghanistan. He committing more strikes, committing more troops. It's the worst things that they posture in this manner that, you know, your personal hatred of Hillary, it's going to cause deportations and endless war. Yes, I think the policy outcome of Trump would be horrible. But if you're nominally against these things, you would give a fuck at all about this fucking horror that goes on in front of us instead of writing these moral invectives about people you heard third-hand accounts of online.
Because they're absolutely clear in saying that they see Hillary as she's going to be a continuation of the Obama administration, and that they're fucking happy about
they're
that.
They're fine with that.
Totally fine with it.
Yeah, they're fine with that. And they, you know, they said, like, you know, people who want revolution rather than reform. Dude, I know Bernie Sanders has said that he's leading a political revolution, but, like, I that's just language.
I love that when people freak out and go crazy about that, like, as though the concept of like branding and like using words that have been proven to be effective in American context doesn't exist. It's like, yeah, it's not fucking revolution, but America has a boner for the concept of revolution.
Yeah.
It sounds good. It makes people feel heroic. But if the actual program is genuine, like genuinely incremental and genuinely pragmatic movement towards creating a broad enough electoral coalition to move the political center of gravity left, yeah, I agree. It's not a revolution. But that's something that will make people want to invest in it because it gives them that sort of romantic tinge that is a necessary component of inspiring people in the American political context.
Goldberg closes by just saying, you know, she goes on and on describing this view from nowhere, which she qualifies by saying she doesn't even know if it's real or not. But she just closes by saying, increasingly, a vocal part of the left is marked by its contempt for liberalism. The feeling is often mutual. The feeling is often mutual. And no, that you're right, Michelle.
The feeling is entirely
mutual. It's entirely mutual. This is productive.
This has been the best outcome of the Sanders campaign, is sharpening the real differences between the left and the liberals. And it's also why a Hillary Clinton presidency is going to be would be more productive for the left. Forgetting all the stuff about how terrible Trump would be on a policy level, is that Trump gets in and we're back to fucking, shrubwatch.org era of liberalism, when everybody's under one horrible fucking tent and all differences get subsumed under the general push against the horrible administration. Hillary gets in and that alienated left is just going to get more alienated. And every fucking day that she carries out more shitty fucking neoliberalism and imperial warfare abroad is going to further that alienation and hopefully, ideally, mobilize more and more people to realize that they are actually on the left and they are not on the same team as these people.
Yeah, I think that's well stated. What do you think? Is there anything more to say about this?
And I did want to say one more thing to try to top this off and sort of as a to give our audience sort of an expectation of what to see during this newly emerging general election campaign between Hillary and Trump. And if anyone saw the just brain-meltingly depressing garbage about the delete your account email that Hillary sent to Donald Trump and just wanted to put their head in a fucking microwave, it's only going to get worse, folks, because I have realized that this campaign, the closest analog I can think of is that in the 1930s, there was a psychologist named Harry Harlow who did a series of experiments to find out what the source of a child's appreciation for their parents was. So he set up a tank with infant rhesus monkeys, and he gave them two mother figures in his tank. One of them was just a bare wire structure, but it also contained inside of it the milk that the monkey needed to live. The other one didn't have any milk, but was covered in sort of a carpeting to give it to give the monkey like solace. And it was the test was to find out which one he preferred. Was he just going where the food was, or was he looking for something more? And for our purposes, let's just say that the Trump campaign is the carpet mother, and the carpet is, you know, the hair, obviously. And the wire mother is Hillary, and the milk bottle is, you know, non-refundable tax credits and Beyonce gifts. And now, it doesn't really matter for our purposes which the monkeys preferred, but I think what's important to remember is that in the actual experiment, the monkeys, who for our purposes are the American electorate, all went insane. They were all driven fucking insane, and they all died shortly after the experiment was over. So
if only
that's where we're headed for.
God, if only the election could have been
buckle up.
If only the election could have been more like one of those experiments where they just give lab rats cocaine until their fucking hearts explode. Yeah.
That would have ruled.
I would have.
I'm making like the accelerationist argument right now.
And they give an electrode in the pleasure center, and then like they can hit a bar. And it hits it, and like they hit the bar until they die. Like they never eat again.
I want that experiment.
That kind of well, the thing is that experiment is basically like the consumer culture that we live in. Like it's the internet, it's fucking fast food, it's everything. We're hitting the bar, and our brains are now dissolving.
Chapo is that bar for our audience.
I think Chapo,
get those endorphins, son.
I think Chapo is kind of the Milgram experiment, except with an electric shock. It's a sip of lean. Press the button to make the subject sip some lean.
Oh man, yeah. I guess to close this one out, you know, I there's probably a dozen Bernie supporters that are going to vote for Trump in the general election. I suspect many of them will simply not vote if they live in a state that's going to go blue anyway. But, you know, it'll affect this election as much as the Pumas affected the election in 08, which is to say, not one whit.
Yeah. If you fuckers lose this, it's your own fucking fault.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, just accept it. You nominated a candidate who is an avatar of a collapsing, failed, miserable status quo. That's what you did.
And she
loses, that's why.
And you might be able to eke it out for, you know, for this one, but man, as
and then Matt, get ready as, for President Tom Cotton in 2020.
Matt,
folks.
Yes, as you strap already in. Said, it's, oh God. Okay.
If I could go to Ladbrokes and like put $5 on him at like 2001 or something, I would totally do it.
I mean, if you are a Chapo listener in the Beltway, please, please seduce Tom Cotton. Please. It's the only way that all three hosts are not going to get drafted into the first American-Iranian war. Take one for the team,
Some young brave chaphead needs to go out there and put on some Dracar Noir and honeypot that motherfucker.
And suck Tom Cotton's dick in a bathroom. But get pictures of it.
Start with a wide stance. Go from there.
I believe in you. I believe in you, Grey Wolves. This is you are the honeypot that this country needs for this operation.
Please. I mean, I know some of you out there are lifters. You do squats. Rub it in Tom Cotton's face, please.
We know 110% of you are men, so yeah. You know, you fit the profile.
You do. I need you, the 5% of the 110%, we need you to do whatever it takes, and whatever it takes is having sex and filming it with Tom Cotton so we can save the lives of millions of Americans and Iranians, please.
So we can prevent World War III.
Yeah.
Just get some thirsty-ass text messages from Tom Cotton talking about, you know, how he wants to fill your boy hole.
Get Tom Cotton to talk about how he wants to fly to Honduras. Wait, wrong guy. Whoops.
Wait, why? What the fuck does Honduras have to do with
it? Oh, I don't know.
Forget it.
No,
Felix is went too hard at the gym today, folks.
Yeah, sorry, guys.
Okay. Okay, moving on. The other, I guess, big news from this week was the bankruptcy of Gawker. That, you know, and the completion of Peter Thiel's Count of Monte Cristo, like, revenge plot against Gawker Media. So, I don't know. Where do you guys want to begin with this?
My revenge against these libertines, endorsers of a pluralistic society where women can vote, will be complete when you are done testifying against them, Mr. Hogan. Hey, brother, are you one of those French queers that still does women?
I want him to wear a Dr. Doom mask at all times.
I
want to
hear, like, all the interplay between Hulk Hogan and Peter Thiel, because Peter Thiel is one of the strangest motherfuckers on Earth, and Hulk Hogan is, like, a pro wrestler who lost 4 inches of height by doing pro wrestling so much. Like, Peter Thiel was probably... He was just, going on long rants about revenge and, like, the nature of a plan coming together and how patience always wins out. And Hulk Hogan was asking him, like, what part of Australia he's from.
You know, so this was a fucking a banner week for Peter Thiel, because he got Gawker to file bankruptcy, but he finished out the week by traveling to Turkey to address the annual meeting of the Property and Freedom Society, which is a libertarian academic group founded by a man named Hans Hermann Hoppe,
This most insane man on earth, in case anyone doesn't know who that guy is.
You know, he's addressing this group that includes the Society's inaugural meeting featured Paul Gottfried, the American white nationalist who founded the H.L. Mencken Club, along with Tom Sinek, another white nationalist and ex-Croatian diplomat who spends his time speaking at racist gatherings on both sides of the Atlantic. Here's who else is attending this conference. The American Freedom Party, the American Renaissance Conference, the National Policy Institute. This is all this alt-right neo-Nazi shit. And then
I definitely think this dude should be in charge of deciding which journalistic enterprises can exist.
Oh, absolutely. Joining Thiel in Turkey, I'm reading, of course, from the Southern Poverty Law Center's website right now, but it says, joining Thiel in Turkey will be... Oh, wait, I'm sorry. This is in September. So Thiel isn't doing it this weekend. He just announced that he will be attending this week. But this is Hans Hermann Hope. And by the way, we should have Matt Brunig on to talk about Hans Hermann Hope, because I learned about him.
Oh, God, he's a mutant.
I learned about Hans Hope.
He lives in a fucking cave. He lives in, like, a bunkhouse in Turkey surrounded by a flaming gasoline moat or something.
I would love to have Matt Brunig on to discuss this guy, because I learned about him through Matt. And holy shit, this guy Hans Hermann Hope is, like, for people who thought Murray Rothbard's free market for infants was problematic because in a free market you may be forced to buy a infant of the wrong color. This is what Hans Hermann Hope writes about. It says Hope has called immigration to the United States and Europe forced integration, and he wrote of it, "If only towns and villages could and would do what they did as a matter of course until well into the 19th century in Europe and the United States, to post signs regarding entrance requirements to the town, and once in town for entering specific pieces of property, i.e. no beggars or bums, no homeless, but also no Muslims, Hindus, Jews, Catholics, etc., and to kick out those who do not fulfill those requirements as trespassers." Folks, this is what they mean by the rights of property. This is what the libertarian ideal of property is, and this is what Peter Thiel basically, this is his ideology, is the utter supremacy of the freedom of property over every other freedom you can conceivably think of.
Yeah, this guy is basically, he has taken libertarianism to its obvious conclusion, whereas he's turned it into feudalism, which makes sense because it sort of has the same concept of all relationships being bilateral, right? It's like there's no sort of concept of a social group. There's just individuals in contract with one another, which that's kind of what feudalism was. And that's what he envisions the future of libertarianism.
And then they quote from a profile of Thiel in The Economist, The Economist, not exactly a left-wing publication, but they write of Thiel, "He is not so much a libertarian as a corporate Nietzschean who believes that in the power of the gifted entrepreneurs to change the world through sheer force of will and intellect."
God damn it. I mean, at least Reardon Metal was a thing. I mean, it was made up, but like the vision, the Randian vision of like these creators, what did they create? Like the perpetual motion engine that powered Galt's Gulch, and Reardon Metal, which revolutionized train travel. What did these fucking guys do? PayPal and fucking Facebook? Is that really why the poor and unworthy need to drown in a sea of blood so that these fucking assholes can create apps?
Peter Thiel is a fucking cancer on our society who has not done anything to like make.
Wait a minute. Gawker is mean though.
Like Gawker
is mean and snarky sometimes.
Oh, Gawker's mean. They're snarky, but here's the other thing. Gawker has always. I've always found Gawker to be entertaining. Like, I always have checked in on Gawker. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad, but overall they're always entertaining, and I feel that they have done so much more to enrich my life than fucking Peter Thiel or anyone like him has ever done.
Yeah, and I mean, more importantly than that, it doesn't fucking matter if they're good or not. That's the liberal poison that has absolutely destroyed everybody's ability to assess any situation. All these dumbasses on Twitter going, "Wow, you really like Gawker? Motherfucker, we've got a power relationship here, okay, in which the implication is that billionaires will be able to underwrite the destruction of any fucking journalistic outfit that they don't like. It doesn't matter the specifics. It doesn't matter the personalities involved." Well, it's certainly interesting that in this case the personality is literally Dr. Doom, but that's the fucking principle and the structural relationship is what's unnerving.
Well, okay,
and should fucking terrify anybody.
Well, to that point, someone I want to like. I saw a quote. I saw something this week from that guy Robbie Sove. He, like, writes for Reason or something. He's, like, a knockoff Milo. Yeah. He's, like, a knockoff Milo Yabba-Dabba-Duopolis. Like, he's, like, a second-rate Milo, basically. And he had a...
Has he had a bunch of incels in Make America Great Again hats carry him around in a sedan chair? I think not.
No, he hasn't. He definitely hasn't. He just wears sort of, like, lime green V-neck t-shirts and, like, you know, YOLO boat shoes everywhere. But, you know, Robbie Sove had a tweet this week where he said... would you, like, if a left-wing billionaire took it upon himself to have a vendetta against a right-wing publication and bankrupt them, like, would you be standing up for the right-wing publication? I thought not. And my response to that is, of course I wouldn't be standing up for the right-wing publication. I fucking hope some George Soros bankrupts the Weekly Standard or National Review. Like, because I have to balance, I guess, the overall principle just against the world we actually live in, you know? I would much prefer that there just weren't billionaires to begin with and that, like, no one individual had enough money or power to, like, live out every one of their idiotic, like, vendettas or fantasies against media institutions. But as long as that's the world we live in, I think it would be funny as hell if someone sued the Weekly Standard or Commentary Magazine into bankruptcy. Is that unfair?
I think it is. Where the fuck else are we going to do our weekly readings from? You're really fucking shooting yourself in the nose despite your face right here.
Right.
You are being a hypocrite, but the thing is, but not in any meaningful way. And the thing is that the structure we live in kind of requires hypocrisy to function, like, on a day-to-day level and to stay sane. Because the contradictions are so obvious and glaring.
At the end of the day, I like Gawker and I despise Peter Thiel. I mean, do I need a better reason than that? Like, it's pretty simple.
It's pretty fucking easy. I mean, Gawker, no matter what you think about, like, you know, I don't know, whoever you hate there. Let's just take one of their verticals, for example. I hate every fucking media term. Let's take one of their sites, for example, Deadspin. Deadspin has done fucking amazing reporting on college rape by athletes, about it getting covered up. They have launched the careers of, like, more great writers than I can count. They give a space for a type of writing that cannot exist anywhere else.
No, Deadspin completely changed the way, I think, the way sports are covered, which absolutely, up until then was just this utterly sycophantic, like, ESPN model, where it's just like, you know, tell us again, Roger Goodell, like, why is football great, you know?
I have to say, I think that we'll all get our preferred ending to this when Peter Thiel inevitably bankrupts himself trying to create a life extension tube. He, like, spends $500 billion on a machine to keep his head alive.
Yeah, I mean, I like that the people who are arguing, like, in the right of politeness, are arguing for Peter Thiel, who's a fucking psycho, who doesn't think women should be allowed to vote, who just fucking regularly hangs out on his seasteading oil rigs with white supremacists. Like, he did this to protect politeness. No, he did this because Gawker revealing that he's gay, like, everyone in Silicon Valley knew he was gay, but the people that didn't know he was gay were his Saudi investors. And, hey, that caused a bit of a problem because they're a little bit into the traditional values, one might say. It was a money thing at the end of the day. This guy doesn't give a fuck about your liberal idea of politeness. He doesn't give a fuck about whatever stupid fucking personal grudge you have against Gawker writer X. But... because
he would happily enslave you.
Happily.
And, like, if anything, like, I would say he's probably not a racist, because I think he just thinks that slavery should just be anyone who's beneath him, regardless.
And that's pretty much everyone.
Yeah. I mean,
he's,
like,
every day is working towards a future that is the earth as a boiling, lifeless, just wasteland, and he's zipping around with his fucking head stitched to, like, a jet-powered skateboard that has laser beams on it or something.
Yeah, this fucking asshole wants to be Mega Man, but shoot his power gun at poor people. And you people are like, ah, oh, finally, comeuppance. Peter Thiel, when Peter Thiel finally gets his Terminator eye readout and he looks at you, fucking Girth Gruther from the Daily whatever fucking conservative shit publication, he looks at you and his heads up display reads, like, 87 life force could be used to power Tesla for 45 minutes, he would shoot you in the head with a fucking cattle gun and burn your inside so he could drive up and down the bay. He doesn't give a fuck about you or anyone else.
No, yeah, so... again, and the precedent that this sets is awful, even though I will admit it could theoretically be used to make Jonah Goldberg get a real job for once in his life, which would be hilarious. But again, I have to weigh my enjoyment of that against the broader principle, and I'm not sure where I come up. But, you know, foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds, as someone once said.
Yeah, I believe that was the Joker.
Okay, yeah, so Peter Thiel basically, I think, should be set adrift into the Pacific Ocean. And, like, I think they should, the U.S. government should let him secede, but, like, let him, but, like, just exile him to the Deepwater Horizon drilling platform. And just, like, with there, with his cadre of, like, boy servants, and just ignore him and just, like, sequester him on that oil rig and live out his weird libertarian, you know, property right fantasy, you know, in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico. I guess we consider that one a duck hunt, and let's hope Peter Thiel goes after Chapo now. Maybe this will get us some press.
I would rather die than pay Peter Thiel a red cent. So yeah,
we'll take to the fucking hills in that case. Yeah. We'll be broadcasting a pirate signal.
This could get interesting, folks. But I have one last story here. This is sort of the odd one out. It doesn't fit in with anything else we've been talking about, but I just want to talk about it because I saw it last week and I loved it. It's one of these stories where you sort of you form a caricature in your head of certain types of people or certain professions based on your prejudices. And then a news story comes along that confirms all of them. And it's just like, it's a really good feeling. So this is in the Washington Post. The headline is, "A warning left on a nanny's car, license plate stolen, and a top Pentagon official in big trouble."
Uh-oh.
The article begins, this is by John Woodrow Cox. The article begins, "The mystery that for weeks unnerved this quiet Capitol Hill neighborhood began with a warning placed on a nanny's windshield. 'I know you are misusing this visitor pass to park here daily,' the April 4th note read. 'If you do not stop it, I will report it. Have your car towed, and the resident who provided this to you will have his privileges taken away.' Baffled, the young couple who employ the nanny sent out a message on the community email group asking for the note's anonymous author to contact them. No one came forward. Instead, 2 days later, the nanny's license plates were stolen from her SUV, according to charging documents. 2 days after that, another plate was stolen. Then, in late April, the thief struck once more." That's three license plates stolen
from
this woman's car.
The thief fucking rules. I love them.
But this time, the couple caught him on a video camera they had mounted inside the couple's their home front window. The alleged culprit? In an Only in Washington story, police identified him as Brian Whitman, a top Pentagon official who had worked in the Defense Department for more than two decades. After handing...
Goddamn nanny is parking in my fucking spot! Get me the wild man!
After handing over the plates to police and being charged with three counts of misdemeanor theft... He stole this woman's license plate three times.
This guy fucking rules. I love
Whitman,
this guy.
58, agreed to a deal Tuesday that would lead to the case's dismissal if he paid $100,000 in restitution, performs 32 hours of community service, and remains out of trouble for the next 10 months, and stays away from both the nanny and the woman for whom she works. This is just the punchline to this whole story. A former political appointee who also worked at the Pentagon was just stunned. "I mean, I'm speechless. I don't even know what to say, frankly," he said. "I've always found him to be a good guy. I relied on his advice a lot." Both describe Whitman as meticulous, organized, and professional. Another senior department official and reporters who knew him said, "He's a stickler for following the rules."
Okay, that is the one thing I get from this guy. This guy fucking loves rules.
I'm just imagining this guy going out at like 3 a.m. with like night vision goggles on some Rainbow Six shit, trying to unscrew the license plate, but then realizing he only has a Phillips head.
It's like the Watergate burglars.
Oh yeah, exactly. Okay.
Like they're totally, you know, these like totally self serious agency veterans, and they're just like, oh, somebody took the tape off of the door jam. Well, let's put it on again, the wrong way, so you can see it.
I just this uptight motherfucker whose job is to basically lie to the press about whatever the fucking Defense Department is up to, is terrorizing this poor nanny for parking on his street. It's like
she represents the idiocy of today.
You're in league with that moronic woman. You're part of a league of morons. Oh, yes. You see, you're one of the morons I've been fighting my whole life. My whole fucking life. But guess what? Today, I win.
Oh, honestly, this nanny is lucky to be alive.
Yeah, no, this guy, like, if this guy had had a slightly worse day, like, if he had seen somebody had sent his wife a Grubhub promo code, like, this woman would be decomposing in a barrel. This woman would be sleeping with Barry Seal right now.
Oh, man. She's gonna get black bagged and sent to like a black site in Poland.
Yeah, what if half the people at the airbase in Baku, Azerbaijan, like half of them are people they suspect for terror attacks, but the other half are people who have minorly inconvenienced Pentagon psychopaths?
there's an unregistered aircraft carrier floating somewhere in the Indian Ocean, and it's just filled with waiters who spilled things. fucking accountants and shit.
Like people at Best Buy who like wouldn't let them return like a broken DVD player because quote we bought it that way. But again, it's just like whenever I think about these, you know, Pentagon DOD wearing suits, this is what I think about.
This
I think about
them.
Guys like that. And, yeah, and, like, it also made me think of the War Nerd this week interviewed this woman about the growth in the D.C. and Virginia suburbs of these grotesque McMansions that have all been basically paid for by the explosion in war on terrorism-related budgets for the whole nexus of, you know, the federal government and private contractors who just have engorge themselves on war profiteering over the last decade or so. And this is who they are, folks. They're fucking terrorizing some poor nanny for parking on their block in front of their what I'm sure is like the world's ugliest, most garish house.
It's like, just imagine all of the shitheads on every Bravo show about like turds who live in subdivisions yelling at each other and throwing wine. Imagine them with access to nuclear codes.
Yeah, imagine if the Property Brothers in one episode blew up a hospital. Imagine if like the House Flipping Virgins or whatever other fucking show, imagine if they were shooting detainees in the kneecap.
Okay. I think that wraps it up for this week. But I actually I haven't told you guys, but I do have a song I want to play to go out our outro with, and I chose it, and I think it actually lines up very well with what we've been talking about this week. The song is evidently Chicken Town by John Cooper Clarke, and I know this song because it was featured at the very end of one of the best Sopranos episodes. It was, I think, one of the best like closing scenes in all of the Sopranos run. It's in one of the late seasons, in the last season, where Phil Leotardo finally decides to just like take over the New York, become the New York boss and take out the guy. And he's like, no more, Butchie. No more. I'm not taking it on the chin anymore. And then it cuts to Tony at Christopher's the baptism of his son.
Yes.
And it's like it's a completely
his daughter.
Yeah. It's
Christopher was a Hillary man.
And like it starts with Phil Leotardo just like about to start a war, and it's just like the most ominous sounding song. And the way they play it on the show is so perfect because it's like Tony and Christopher embrace, but like just the feeling of doom is so pervasive, and you just know that worse things are to come. So, a theme on the show. Okay, guys, till next week or till our next premium show in the middle of the week. What do you say?
Yeah, we got a good guest for you guys this week, by the way.
Yeah, we'll big that up later in the week. But, all right, we're out. See ya.
Peace.
Bloody cops are bloody keen, bloody keep it bloody clean. Bloody cheats are bloody swine, bloody draws the bloody line. A bloody fun and bloody games, a bloody kids in bloody blames. Nowhere to be bloody found, anywhere in Chicken Town. The bloody scene is bloody sad. The bloody news is bloody bad. The bloody weed is bloody turf. The bloody speed is bloody surf. Bloody folks are bloody daft. Don't make me bloody laugh. Bloody hurts to look around. Everywhere in Chicken Town. Bloody train is bloody late. Your bloody way, your bloody way. Bloody lost and bloody found. Stuck in fucking Chicken Town. Bloody waiting, bloody wait, bloody lost and bloody found. Don't you fucking Chicken Town.